With free next-day delivery from Staples, you can run your business like a pro. You can guarantee the marketing department that they'll get their supplies tomorrow, and guarantee the accounting department that they'll be delivered free. With free next-day delivery, you'll have the ability to move deadlines up and adjust budgets down. Go to staples.com and get the office essentials you need delivered next day for free. Staples. It's pro time. Orders over $49.99. Place by 5 p.m. Excludes weekends and holidays. Eligible items only.
Blog Talk Radio.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. All three engines up and burning. 2, 1, 0, and liftoff.
Coach on Fire Radio.
Fire the tire.
Well, hello and welcome to the 37th episode of the Being Brilliant radio show. This is Amy Hackett-Jones, your host, happiness and high performance coach and hypnotist for being brilliant in the way you both live and lead your life and those around you. You can find me at www.amyhackett.jones.com. The Being Brilliant radio show is a deep and impactful look at what it takes to be brilliant. The show invites you, our listeners, to step into the very essence of who you are being as you show up to life. My guests bring a combination of inspirational teachings coupled with practical tools and essential life and leadership skills translated into actionable strategies so that you, our listeners, may step into being the very best version of yourselves. Now, my interviewees are high performers, thought leaders, game changers, pioneers, dreamers, adventurers, wayseers, visionaries, as well as friends and family, those whom I believe live brilliantly and who travel magically through life, shining their own light so others may do the same. And of course, today is of no exception. And I have somebody I absolutely cannot wait to interview today. I'm very, very excited. Her name is Mandy Hickson. She's a motivational speaker, coach, mentor, role model for girls in schools. And she's also a former fast jet pilot for the RAF. Mandy, welcome.
Thank you very much, Amy.
Now, I'm just going to read a little bit more about your bio here because it's really quite spectacular and this is why I'm so excited.
Okay.
I know that your dream from a long time ago was to be an RAF pilot, and you made that happen, and you were the second woman to fly a Tornado GR4 on the front line, completing 3 tours of duty and 45 missions over Iraq.
That's right.
Gosh, I can't wait to dive into that. And on your bio, you also say, when life is on the line, pilots must be rigorously trained and exercise carefully planned and be evaluated. Sorry. There is much we can share with business from such careful strategy training, planning and debriefing.
Yeah.
You became a squadron's combat survival and rescue officer, working closely with the US, instructing squadron members on escape and evasion tactics. And throughout your time, Mandy, you were the only female aircrew and later learned the lessons of juggling life as a working mother of 2 young children.
That's right, yes. It's probably the biggest challenge of all, Amy.
I know, I can imagine. So now you're a civilian and you're drawing on your experiences in the RAF to train and inspire others.
Yes.
And you cover the core areas of human factors, decision-making, communication, leadership, behavior, workload, conflict, fatigue, and stress management. You're a highly sought after keynote speaker in business and education.
Gosh, so, it makes me sound incredible, doesn't it? I'm actually I'm hearing that.
You're still a volunteer reserve for the RAF, isn't that right?
Yeah, that is, yeah.
And you enjoy teaching air cadets to fly. And you support your local community as a chair of one of the local tennis club, and we were just talking about tennis a moment ago offline. And you enjoy spinning, cycling, hill walking, and taking to the slopes in winter.
Absolutely, as much as I can possibly get out there.
Yes, sounds like we're very like-minded. So amazing. You had 17 years in the RAF, is that correct?
Yes, it is. I left just over 5 years ago now, having completed my my contract, which was to my 38th birthday.
Goodness me. So tell me, I love to dive into people's lives and their dreams, especially if they were fairly long-held dreams and they made them materialize. What was it that wanted you, that made you want to become a fighter pilot?
Well, it was really that? Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I grew up, my grandfather was a Second World War fighter pilot. And so from a very, very early age, I grew up listening to his stories. But I wasn't that interested. I wasn't one of these real keen beans that goes to all the air shows or anything like that. Neither of my parents were in the military. But I cannot tell a lie. I was sitting watching my very favourite programme on television, which at the time was Tom Selleck in Magnum. I was 13 years old and I had an infatuation with Magnum. And my mum was sitting on the sofa next to me. She was reading the local newspaper. And there was an article in there describing all about the Air Training Corps, which is a club run by the Royal Air Force for 13 to 18-year-olds. And it was opening its doors to girls for the very first time the following week. And she said, this is something that I might be really interested in doing. And I sort of said, yeah, that does sound interesting. You know, what night's it on? And she pointed out it was on a Tuesday night. Unfortunately, Magnum was on television on a Tuesday night. And this was in the days before, you know, catch-up TV and video recorders. And I was not going to miss my favourite man on television. So I said, well, I'm not interested. I'm sorry. And she said, but they do canoeing, Mandy. You know, you like canoeing. I said, well, I do like canoeing, but not as much as Magnum. And she said, sort of came down with the killer line where she finally said to me, Mandy, you go to an all-girls school. This is going to be your only opportunity in life to meet some boys. And I joined immediately. So, you know what? I sometimes think what a fantastic sales pitch that my mum had and obviously knew how to float, you know, inspire me at that moment in my life as a 13-year-old girl. So, yes, it was when I joined there that I flew for the first time. And I think once my feet left the tarmac, you know, that suddenly ignited this absolute passion in a career in the air.
Goodness me. Wow, what an amazing intro to fly.
It's probably not the answer you were expecting, was it?
No, it wasn't.
I'm full of surprises.
Oh, I bet you are. Oh, how fantastic. So your passion was lit and you were on fire.
Yeah, absolutely.
Amazing.
I'm a real believer as well, though. I think I consider myself to be incredibly lucky because I look around now and I think actually what is often missing for a lot of youngsters is that knowledge or any idea of where they want to go in life. And, you know, I understand that, you know, I have two lovely stepchildren who finished university still going, I've still got no idea. And I think, you know, to have that vision, an idea of where you want to go so young, is actually quite a privileged position to be in, because then I think you can sort of almost structure and visualize your life as to how you want it to fall. And even from a sort of a youngish age of sort of 14, 15, to suddenly have that idea in front of you is very, very powerful. So, you know, I consider myself very lucky to have had that opportunity.
Absolutely. And to have, like you said, had that vision and to be able to follow it through, to be encouraged to follow it through.
Yeah, definitely.
And listening to your grandfather's stories as well, that must have been fascinating.
Yeah, it was fascinating, actually, because, I mean, he was a really interesting character in himself, because he was always described as being a very mature 22-year-old, because actually he was 28, and he was so desperate to be a pilot, and they were so desperate for pilots to be joining the Air Force around the Second World War time, he realised he was too old to join. So he simply, let's just say, forged a new date of birth for himself about sort of 7 years younger, so hence a very mature cuttle, as he was described on every single training report. And I think everybody knew this, but I think they were so desperate to get pilots through and trained up that they were sort of willing to allow small slips, even though that they probably were very aware of what was actually going on. But no, he was a real character inside himself.
Oh, how funny. It's wonderful. So tell us of these tours that you went on, what are one or two of the most impactful moments for you as you were then, perhaps as a pilot, and then now looking back, the leadership lessons that you learned in the process?
I think one of the most powerful memories I have was it was just coming up to the end of my first tour of duty out in Iraq, and I'd only been on my squadron for a matter of months when our when two squadron, which was my squadron, were deployed out to cover the no-fly zone over southern Iraq, and it was called Operation Telic. And we were based out of Ali al-Salem, which is just outside Kuwait City. And we worked really closely with all of our American friends who were based out of some out of Kuwait as well, but also some down in Saudi Arabia as well. So you were trying to coordinate enormous coalitions of aircraft to go across the border at any one time. You know, you could have up to about 80 aircraft going over. So you imagine the communication skills that you need to communicate exactly where you're going to be at what points, because the worst situation, and we've always felt that, is that if you have a blue on blue incident where two friendly aircraft hit each other, so that's always our biggest concern. So one of the big things that we learned was about how we communicate, because I always find working with the Americans is absolutely fantastic, but we do share the same language, but we have so many words that mean different things that it can actually almost be quite confusing at times. Yeah. And we could often say something and it would be completely misinterpreted. And before we went out to the Gulf, we had the opportunity of going out to Nellis Air Force Base, which is just outside Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. And we had an exercise called Exercise Red Flag, which is basically a real live Top Gun. You're flying across the Nevada desert in an area the size of Northern Ireland, pretty much. It's about 15,000 square miles of airspace that you use as well. And we had 12 different nationalities all coming together to practice for that. And because you're practicing scenarios out there that are almost worse, you know, more complex than you would hope to ever come across in Iraq. By the time you get to Iraq, you've almost trained harder than you fight. So it should be therefore easier in the war zone itself, which is the whole perception of doing that and the whole reasoning behind that. That's why they spend so much money on the training. But working in America with the Americans was, as I said, fantastic. We would head over, and on my last night out there, I was given the opportunity to lead a four-ship of aircraft. And we, being a really quiet night, it was, we took about 10 o'clock at night, and the mission lasted about 3 hours. We were just sweeping up our last target, which was quite close to the Kuwaiti border, when suddenly my navigator in my back seat just shouted to me to break right. And this was, a sort of a key word that we would use to carry out a maneuver to evade a surface-to-air missile. And so I instantly reacted to his call, because he said it with panic in his voice. It was like, break right! So I instantly broke right. I slammed myself fully forward. You know, I rolled to 120 degrees. I pulled very hard towards the ground. At the exact moment that we've practiced so many times before, he emits the flares and releases flares from our aircraft. And these acted as a decoy, because he'd been wearing his night vision goggles, and it just so happened he had looked at this point on the ground and saw a surface-to-air missile launching at us, locking onto our heat source, which is our engines. It was really quite frightening, actually. But as we did this maneuver, we watched the flares leave our aircraft, and they filled your, we have these little mirrors inside the cockpit so you can see behind you, and they literally filled the night sky. And we watched the missile go from being locked onto us to picking up on the flares, and it exploded about 2 miles away from our cockpit. And, you know, when you think about this as a maneuver, we'd practiced hundreds of times, but never for real. And if I'd got it wrong, it really would have been fatal for us both. So it was, let's say, quite a heart stopping moment. But what then followed was really interesting. Because of those 80 aircraft, the way it works out there with your rules of engagement was that, you know, once an aggressive act has been made towards any one of those aircraft, we were then entitled to prosecute an attack on a target. And our target was a radar station that we'd flown over earlier on that trip. And we later discovered it was this radar station that had handed out the height of our aircraft to this unknown surface-to-air missile cell. So, you know, it's all very well and good when you go to, go to war, or you go to a briefing, that you're given all the information. But you can't obviously brief for every single eventuality. And often it's these latent threats, the ones that, you know, reside within systems that you're not aware of, that are the ones that catch you out. And when we do brief, you know, we cover every single thing. What if we lose an engine? What if our navigation kit's not good? What if the weather's poor? What if? So actually, if a scenario then does unfold, it shouldn't be an emergency because you've just briefed for it. And I think that's a really good, you know, lesson when you take it across into, say, business, because so often they don't like to look at threats because that's not the sexy side of business, is it? You know, that, you know, businesses tend to look at all of the opportunities and they look at that, how the growth, and but actually the threat is the bit that really can be the one that actually underpins and pulls the whole business apart. You know, you can see it so many times and it's the unexpected. When we were given our target of this radar station, chaos broke out on the airwaves, and our commander-in-chief, who was in his AWACS aircraft over the Persian Gulf, told us to stand by while a plan was formulated. But unfortunately, we're running out of fuel. So you've got to make some really quick decisions. And in the military, we're taught a decision-making model. It's called DODAR. You diagnose the problem, you look at options, you describe that to the team, and then you get their input. And then you, as the leader, makes the decision. You assign tasks and you review it, go back to the start. And we ran through the DODAR process, and I decided to take my team down to a tanker in Saudi Arabia because it would open up our options again, because at the time we were running out of fuel and we had exactly enough to get from where we were to our target, prosecute an attack and return back to base, but, you know, not an ounce more. We went down into Saudi Arabia, and when we got there, our British tanker had become unserviceable, and the lovely Americans had replaced it with one of their tankers, something called a KC-135. And I wasn't qualified to refuel on one of these aircraft. So suddenly you're learning, you're meant to be learning a new skill in a war zone at night. So talk about pressure and stress. It was as high as you can imagine, I think. I had two attempts to refuel and I wasn't successful. And I said to my backseater, I'm going to stop. And he actually said, press on. And it was in that moment when you suddenly realise that all of these leadership lessons that you've been learning really apply, because you've got a team that are around you with more qualified people on it. I mean, my boss happened to be my number two in the formation. My senior executive officer happened to be my number three. So suddenly, when you talk about hierarchical gradient, you have got the junior team member leading with a very, very senior team. And actually, you realise that on that night, we had a job to do. And if it didn't involve us to take part in that final stages, then actually I had other people to do it. And so I moved across onto the wing and I allowed my rest of my teammates to refuel. The number two and number three were successful, but myself and number four were not. We returned back to base, and number two and three went back into Iraq with the F-15s fighter cover from the Americans, locating the radar station, and they destroyed it. And I landed back at base that night feeling really low. I felt like a real failure. I thought, you know, you've gone through all this training and you can't even perform at that final stages. And it was interesting because the first thing that happened when we got out of the aircraft was that Ringo put his hand on my shoulder and just said, you know, good call, Mandy. I am so sorry. I should never have said to you, you know, to push on, to press on. You made the right decision there. Well done. And your shoulders go back a bit more when you hear that from a really experienced navigator. And then we waited for the rest of our team to come back. And, you know, we started debriefing because we always debrief every single flight. You always go through it to learn. And we were pulling out all the pertinent facts, and we heard from the commander-in-chief that actually we had a direct hit on target. We were one of the only formations to go back over the border, and our mission was 100% successful. And when I'd heard that, that's when your shoulders just go back and you really are standing tall, because that's the moment you realise actually what it feels like to be part of a really highly performing team. One, knowing that you're going to make decisions that will affect lives of people around you, and knowing you're going to be held accountable. And also, you know, when you look at the leadership aspect of that, and I'm not talking about my own, my boss's leadership was exemplary that night, because, you know, he trusted this junior team member, me, to lead on her first ever combat mission. The complexity when we got shot at shot through the roof, and it must have been really tempting for him to step in and just say, I'm going to take control. She's outside of her capability and her limits. Mm-hmm. But he didn't. He stepped back and he let me grow. He let me lead. And I learned more on that night because, you know, he didn't even get what's that lovely thing that people get out when somebody's not doing the job exactly how they want it to be done. They get that retractable screwdriver out. They start extending it to poke you and tweak you so that you do it how they want it done. And he didn't. Yes. And you know what? We talk about empowerment in business and empowerment in, you know, in families. But how often, you know, do we say, talk to our children, we sort of tell them, rather than asking them what they want to do, but actually using what they're coming back with and empowering them. When you can never tell people they're empowered. I think you've just got to, you know, provide the right environment, give tools to allow people to grow. And that's what I felt that night. So, yeah, that was a pretty astounding memory and one that I always sort of is pretty clear in my head.
Gosh, that's phenomenal. I can't even imagine the amount of pressure and stress and trying to refuel at that speed midair.
Yeah. Oh, there's a blowing sandstorm going through. There was also a massive queue, you know, that sort of 5p off the Tesco pumps on a Sunday morning. You know, everyone's done the tip run and they're all going to the same place. It felt like that because everybody had gone to this same tanker to refuel as well. So it was chaotic. Oh, but, you know, very, you know,
you
quite
kept your calm
rewarding.
And then. Yeah, amazing.
Only just. But I think it's also, it was a really good lesson for me to learn that there's a time to stop. You know, so often we push on when we're actually not capable, and to actually ask for help and to say, actually, stop, I need other people to step in here. And I think it was a really good lesson to say, you don't always have to be this, you know, brave person that's leading everything. Actually, you've got people that you can rely on and trust. And I think that was a really, really important lesson for me too.
Mm. The power of teamwork.
Yeah, absolutely. It's incredible.
And you know, not only at that height and with lives at risk and all the rest of it, but really the training that you get.
I mean, the training.
It equips you for that, doesn't it? Which,
it really does, actually.
It's not always that way,
no,
is it?
No, it's not. I mean, when you think back, say, to starting in the RAF in the military, and this goes across the military as a whole, you know, one of the very first things that they teach you is about pushing you to almost breaking points so that you realise where your own strengths and weaknesses are. Because I think until you know that, how can you ever lead other people? You know, and then you start to see what strengths other people have in your team. And then you are given opportunities to lead. And, you know, we're taught leadership from day one almost of officer training, as opposed to going into a business where you're taught the tools of the trade. And if you're really good, you might progress. You might get sent on, I don't know, a leadership course or a management course. But that's really far into your career. And I think the reason it works so well in the military is because they're taking everyone as almost like a blank canvas right at the start. Obviously, some people have a lot more leadership skills inherently within their personalities, you know, before they even start. But actually, what it does is it gives you those the ability to realize that we can all be leaders, and leadership is not just like a descriptive term for a position. It's an action. And so what it gives you is the confidence to start, even at the very, very junior levels within a squadron, as you develop through, that you're knowing you're going to be making decisions, that accountability will sit with you as well. But actually, you feel empowered to do that. So most people look into the military and they assume it's really hierarchical. And it is with regards to the structure and the rank. But actually, within a squadron, you know, at a very early stage of your career, you're being challenged and you are leading all the time in different roles. I mean, one of my first jobs as a they're called secondary duties. You know, so I was flying, you know, most days on my squadron, I was given the small task of organising the squadron's 90th anniversary celebrations. And it ended up being a black tie dinner party over a 2-day weekend with jazz luncheons, hog roasts, 450 people for a black tie dinner. And this was just my secondary duty. You know, it was a full on events coordination sort of duty. And I was thinking, my goodness, I'm just doing this in my spare time. And yet, you know, normally, That would be an entire, you know, role for a company to come in and organise an event like that. And yet it was myself and about two other people that were put in charge of it. So that was my first tour, you know. So it's really interesting.
That's just brilliant. I love it. And I love that you get thrown in and really challenged like that.
Yeah, you do.
And we definitely need more of that in business, not just a leadership course here and there to tick a few boxes. So it's actually how do we really bring people out and so that they can perform and they can lead. And I think you touched on something really interesting earlier, which is about empowerment and how it does get used, that word. I feel it kind of gets used too much.
Yeah, I agree.
And not enough people really agree on what it actually is and what it actually means and what it actually looks like to or feels like to be empowered. So what would your definition of empowerment be?
I think when you look at empowerment, I think that classic is that you kind of tell people. So empowerment's got to come from within the person that is feeling empowered. So the leader can't say, right, Amy, you're going to be listening to Mandy and you will feel empowered by me. You won't, you know, you've got to feel it. So that's an interesting one for starters. So it's got to be felt. It's not an action. And I think as if you're looking at trying to empower teams within a leadership scenarios, I think you've just got to step back and you have to allow people to make decisions. You have to allow them and create the right environment and give them tools and skills to enable that. But I sort of tend to think as a leader, your job is an enabler. And one of the best quotes I've ever heard, it was actually a really good friend of mine that was leaving the Navy, and he'd been the captain of a ship. He went for a job with a really big oil and gas company. I won't divulge any names. And in the interview, he said, tell me the best, most powerful leadership moment that you've had that you'd like to share with us experience. And he said, ah, yes, my son had a really, really nasty accident whilst I was captain of the ship. And I had to fly off and I was away from my ship for 4 days and it ran as if I wasn't there. And they sort of laughed at him and they said, well, why is that your leadership? And he said, well, because that's what the leader's doing is basically you're teaching and you're empowering everybody and engaging in them. So actually when the leader is not there, everybody can just step up because they feel to do the job.
That's
and they were like,
brilliant.
And I thought it was really inspirational when he said that. And I thought, you know, that is it about what a really good leader is, isn't it? Somebody that can step out and allow the team to carry on and grow, you know, and you're just there really as a figurehead to help, you know, keep them on that journey, on that boat, really, let's sort of say, to use that analogy. But yeah, it was
fantastic.
Interesting.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. And you experienced that midair at that point, didn't you?
Yeah, no, I did actually. But I'd seen it many times as well. You know, and I think a lot of it is about believing in the people that you work with, you know, and that goes back to trust. So trust is not something, again, that you can just, you know, get immediately. You've got to build trust. And I saw a really lovely equation for trust within teams because it was saying, you know, until we trust people, you know, and actually it's a trust is made up of credibility and reliability. And you know what, to sit around most tables in any businesses, you're going to have those things. But intimacy, you know, how well do you know the members of your team? And I think when you look at businesses these days, this is something that we're losing more and more and more. If I go into businesses as a consultant and I, you know, just sit at the back and watch their meetings and how they take place. Everyone is sitting on their mobile phones until the second before the meeting starts. And then obviously they make this really big gesture of putting it onto silent and putting it down. But they're not necessarily turning it over or putting it away, but they haven't spoken to anybody else around that meeting table. And so how are you going to get to know what's going on in the people's lives around you, who you're working with, unless you are actually chatting to them and finding out? But underpinning all of that, that credibility, reliability and intimacy, is selflessness. And I think when you look at teams that are performing really well, you will see people acting selflessly. And it's when you go the extra mile when you've got nothing to gain. But, you know, as soon as you see that, people start to trust each other because they think, oh, my goodness, you know, that person didn't need to do that, but they did. And you see this teamwork improving and improving. The second that somebody goes, oh, I can look really good if I do so and so, I can shine, then actually the trust breaks down and the teamwork breaks down. And guess what? Performance goes down. So to me, it's all about trying to get, you know, the right people in those jobs. But it's about, you know, trying to engage, trying to understand about, again, it just goes back to those basics of strengths and weaknesses, what's going on in the people's lives that you work with, and about selfless behaviour.
Gosh, that's fantastic.
Sorry, I will let you speak.
Just break it down.
Sorry,
no, wonderful. I'm really taking notes. I'm like, yes, this is brilliant.
Oh, dear.
Fantastic. Well, I will just mention for those who are tuning in late that this is Amy Hackett-Jones of the Being Brilliant radio show, and I'm speaking to Mandy Hixon. She's a former fast jet pilot with the British Royal Air Force. She is now a motivational speaker, coach, mentor, and role model for girls and boys in schools. That was absolutely brilliant. And you can find Mandy at www.hickson, H-I-C-K-S-O-N, LTD.com, HicksUnlimited.com. So, wow, I just absolutely love that. Thank you so much. So we've covered empowerment, we've covered leadership, we've covered trust, believing in your team, credibility, reliability, intimacy, and selflessness within the team.
I've actually got a lovely story. So I'm going through my flying training, actually, and I had a really interesting situation whereby when I wanted to go, well, I'll cover that later, but I was actually in the very final stages of my fast jet training at RAF Valley in Anglesey. A lot of the listeners might have heard of it because it's where Prince William was based for many years, and sadly I was there a bit before him. Otherwise, the royal wedding could have been very different, I actually think. Poor Kate.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I was three trips away from graduating and gaining my RAF wings. And I've been in the flying training system for about 5 years. So, you know, it's a long, old training. And yeah. I failed a flight, not a problem. I'd failed many in the past. I mean, to put it in perspective, there's about 30 to 40% failure rate at each of the stages of flying training. This was my third course. So our course was already down to 7 members. The rest of my course mates had all finished. They were mainly celebrating, let's say, in a more relaxed environment. I, however, failed a flight, so I was given the opportunity to fly it again. I flew it again and I failed it again, and suddenly I got into this spiral, this loss of confidence that comes with it. You've got this enormous pressure riding on your shoulders because, you know, I was given 3 trips and the final flight I would fly is called a chop ride. If you don't pass it, you either get streamed to fly helicopters or multi-engine aircraft, but the slots weren't available for those at the time, so I would have been leaving the Air Force. So this is massive, you know, it's a huge pressure. So, and the flight that I'd failed was, it was putting all our skills together, basically. We'd learn low-level navigation, we'd learn close formation, we'd learn air-to-air combat, like Top Gun. Oh, yes. We were doing something called tactical low-level formation flying, and it's when 2 aircraft go in at very low level, and you have to evade a threat, and the threat is your instructor who's simulating being, you know, the enemy, let's say, yep. Viper in Top Gun, and he's trying to get behind you to simulate shooting you down, and you've got to stick together as a pair, because if you split up, you can't see behind your own aeroplane, but if you're together and working well, you can see in a bubble all the way around him, and you can provide the mutual support that is essential for this sort of flying. And you're also trying to hit targets within, I don't know, plus or minus 5 seconds without a moving map. We had a stopwatch, a paper map and a compass. So it was really challenging, and especially in Wales in November in poor weather. So we've got a lot of challenges against you there. But we were flying together as a pair, and I could do all of it apart from the turns. And every single turn that you do, you have to coordinate it so that you always roll out together, you know, parallel to each other. And this took you basically to working out degrees that you need to roll through to assist your wingman. And I was getting so caught up in the minutiae of these numbers that I was not really thinking about the bigger picture. And, you know, to practice for this, and every time I would roll out from these turns, I would be behind, I would be in front, or I'd be miles apart. And I was just told, you know, Mandy, until you pass this, it's having a knock-on effect on all the other bits, because now you're just concentrating on your flying. You're not hitting your targets and you're not spotting the enemy. So one tiny flaw in a performance can snowball. And, you know, I went back to my room every night. I got my cardboard cockpit out, which was an issue item, by the way. It wasn't something I made. And I put it on my bed and I'd sit in my bed pretending to fly. And I'd go, I'd do all my checks, I'd pretend to take off, I'd make radio calls, I'd answer my own radio calls. I'll be brutally honest, I probably looked like I was on the verge of a breakdown, and I think I probably was, actually. And on this occasion, there was a knock on my door, and it was one of my course mates, Rob, and I knew they'd all been in the bar celebrating. So when there was a knock, he said, Mandy, we want to take you out tonight. I said, you're having a laugh, Rob. I'm going nowhere. He said, oh, do you know what, Mandy? He said, I think it's time you trusted us. Now, when he said that, I thought, actually, what do I have to lose, really? You know, here I am sitting here on my cardboard cockpit. It's not going according to plan. They've all finished. You know, he sort of did say to me, your cockpit's not working that well, is it? I thought, like, thank you, you smug individual. Anyway, he said, please, Mandy, trust me. And I thought, what do I have to lose? Anyway, we went down to the bike sheds. I'll be honest, Amy, the trust started to wane a tad at that point, as you can imagine. And we got onto our bikes, so we cycled off to the other side of the airfield to this big empty hangar. And we were on and we opened the doors of this hangar. And as we entered it, they flicked the light switch on, and waiting in there was the rest of my course mates, all on their bikes. And these guys gave up their evening, 3 hours of pretending to be aeroplanes, cycling in battle formation up and down this hangar as we were doing it, with them yelling, 30 degrees left, 60 degrees right, rotate. We were doing all of the manoeuvres that we were meant to be practicing in the air, time and time again, with them saying, stop looking at the numbers, Mandy, think about the bigger picture. And eventually I suddenly started to click with me, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is so simple. You know, obviously we're doing it without any vertical separation because it is not Harry Potter. But, you know, at the end of it, sort of after a couple of small collisions, you know, it all fell into place. And I slept for the first night in weeks that night. And I went off and flew the trip the next day. I didn't know if I'd passed or not. But when I brought the aircraft to a standstill, my instructor jumped out from behind my aircraft in the back seat. And I saw him descend the steps. And as I turned around, I just glanced to see him bending down and kissing the floor. And I thought, oh no, this doesn't bode well. You know, he's so relieved I haven't killed him. He's, you know, celebrating by kissing the earth to say, thank goodness I'm alive. Anyway, he looked up at me and he said, what the heck was that, Mandy? I thought, oh no, I've failed. And he just said, you know, I really like you, but yesterday you were absolutely rubbish, or words to that effect. And he said, you know, what has happened? Because this has been like flying with a different pilot. You've got a completely different mindset and everything. And I told him what the guys had done the night before. And he said, I'm blown away. And I said, I know, wasn't it nice of them? And he said, Mandy, it's so much more than nice, because something that you don't realize, but the rest of your course mates do, is how many slots there are available in the front line. And for our course, you go through your flight training. We knew there were 6 slots to fly Tornadoes, Harriers and Jaguars. And I was now going to be number 7. Now, another slot would come up, but it might be a year of waiting, of what's called holding, where you go and do a fairly boring job while you're waiting for your course to start. And those guys knew that fact, and they still went the extra mile to get me through, really jeopardizing their own career advancement. And, you know, when we talk about teamwork, that's what we're talking about. That's the selfless behavior that is required to go the extra mile for people, when you, in fact, not just have nothing to gain, but actually it could be a detriment to yourself. But when it was reported up to our boss, he was so impressed by the camaraderie that one of us got the opportunity to stay on as an instructor at Valley, as a creamy, they're called, where they take the very best person off. And so all of us graduated onto our aircraft types of choice, mine being to fly the Tornado, GR4. So it all worked out for the best. But that was a real situation of a real example of selfless teamwork in action.
Gosh.
I've stunned
you. What a brilliant example.
Yes, you did. Sorry.
I'm just picturing it now. It's like something out of a Hollywood epic.
It really is. Well, I'm writing a book at the moment, actually. And it's been funny because yeah, I've got a lovely ghostwriter who's writing it for me, because I realised that was not my skill set. And we've been revisiting all of these stories, and it's just been fantastic. You know, some of them quite emotional as well, actually, going back when certain things have happened, and you just remember it all, and it can be incredibly powerful, actually.
Yeah, and now looking back, the lessons that you've learned, and that you're now teaching in a different business.
Yeah, no, it's been fascinating, actually. Because when I left, I retrained as a commercial pilot, because that's what everybody does when they leave the Air Force. You make this big assumption that you've got one skill set. It's called flying. And so I retrained as a commercial pilot, held my license, and thought, I have no desire whatsoever to do that. My husband does it, and actually I thought, he was in the Navy, he made the transition across, but we had 2 little boys, and I just thought, gosh, if both of us are doing this, this is not going to work. You know, how is it going to ever have a relationship or even be parents? So I retrained then as a human factors consultant. It's called crew resource management in the aviation world. And it basically looks at all the human elements that can help to prevent accidents from happening. And they realized that, in the late 1980s, technology was improving, but actually aircraft kept on crashing, and it was not down then to the technology. It was down to human error in 3 out of 4 incidents. And it still is in 3 out of 4 instances down to human error when we see an accident happening. And they realized that actually there was so much that you could do to educate pilots and cabin crew, air traffic controllers, maintenance engineers, in the way of in which we communicate and make decisions, how we can break down the hierarchical gradient and give people assertiveness tools to enable them to challenge in a non-aggressive manner. And there was loads of lessons that started coming out, and there's 16 subjects, everything from stress to fatigue to cultural change, that we now teach in a mandatory training program in human factors training to all pilots, cabin crew and air traffic controllers every single year. And we have seen a huge improvement in our accident rate, because we only have one incident now in 8.4 million departures. Now, compared to any other industry, that puts us at being one of the safest industries in the world. And it's done, I believe, in a huge part. Well, technology has obviously helped enormously with lots of different safety applications, but I do believe it's the human element that we've made a huge difference to as well. So, yeah, it's been very powerful. And what I did when I left was I realized that we were teaching this to aviation, and yet I was doing motivational speaking to industry. And yet all the lessons that I was learning from the aviation world were so applicable to business, which is why I set up my business experience from the front line, which takes all of those lessons in very easy toolboxes, and some really great sessions, great fun sessions as facilitated training sessions. And it's taken me all over the world at the moment, delivering those training to everyone from, you know, high risk industries like oil and gas and nuclear power sector to the financial sector as well, because it might not be lives that are lost, but it can certainly be billions of pounds when people make mistakes.
Yes. And it's, as you mentioned, it's the human factor. It's really coming down to how can we empower, how can we lead, how can we communicate, how can we be much more assertive? What for you do you think is the future of leadership?
The future of leadership for me sits as being, to hate to coin the empowered net bit, but it's the fact that it's an action and not a position. So it has to be role modelled right from the very outset. And I think, you know, and I know this is never going to probably happen, but, you know, some of the businesses that I go into, especially smaller business, I say, how powerful would it have been if you had your leadership training at the outset of your careers? And they sort of say, well, that could never happen. How would that? Well, it's just simply, you know, starting to drip feed it in from the start. So if you can get people feeling empowered in their leadership traits from the start, actually, you stop this hierarchical gradient of that person sitting at the top and feeling that they're wielding the power. Whereas actually, you end up with a much more proactive approach going on, where people are very happy to challenge. They're happy to actually look at different ways and different solutions. And, you know, lots of the companies as well so often work at having that perfect solution before they move forward. Actually, it's about, perhaps it's not the finished product. Perhaps it's launching something to the team to get people discussing it, to really bring people in right from the outset so that they can all be part of that process, as opposed to just thinking, oh, I don't want to mention it to anyone until it's perfect. And then things just take so much longer. So to me, it's all about engaging people from the outset.
Brilliant. Yeah, I love that. It's not an action, it's a position. I'm not a position, it's an action.
Yeah.
Okay. So as you're coaching and training and speaking in public in industry, what are the top sort of two or three things that you come across, in addition to leadership, but what are the top two things that you come across most that you think need the biggest amount of change, the biggest shift?
The biggest one for me is culture, is cultural change. So when you look at businesses, for example, let's look at the police force, you know, I'm just going to pick them out. I've been working quite a lot with leadership teams within the police force. And one of the big common threads that is said, still feels like there's a blame culture. Now, when you've got the top chief constable saying, well, give me proof, where is that? They often can't come out with particular incidents where somebody felt they were blamed, but often it's just in language that's being used. And so actually, by changing our language, so when something happens, we don't use the words like, well, who was it? We use more phrases like, how long have you known? So you're changing the emphasis on someone to blame to actually, why did we not find out about it earlier? Because I don't care that it's happened, but I want to know, how long have you known? Because actually, all I'm worried about is that we want to act quicker. So if we can look at culture, so to put it in terms of the aviation world, 20 years ago, we had a blame culture. They then realized that they were never learning. And so they moved their culture and said, right, we're going to make every effort to have a no blame culture. And so the seesaw went ping right up the other way. And they suddenly went, actually, that doesn't work either. Because what happens if someone violates, or what happens if, you know, someone acts really inappropriately? There's got to be a line in the sand. And so they developed this saying, and it's called a just culture. It's got a lovely descriptive sentence for it. It says, a just culture is a culture that recognizes that competent professionals will make mistakes. And it even recognizes that those same competent professionals will develop unhealthy norms, shortcuts, you know, routine rule violations, but there's zero tolerance for recklessness. And when you really look at that, you're saying, you know what, every single person here will make a mistake. I just want to know what the mistakes are. If you find yourself stepping out from the norm and you find yourself, I don't know, taking a shortcut with a program or a shortcut with a procedure, either identify it and say, why am I doing that? Is it a better way of doing it? Because guess what? It might well be. Or are you doing it because you're wanting to save time for, I don't know, personal reasons? And actually, if you start talking about those sorts of things, then you're into a learning culture. Because for every, if you can imagine a pyramid or the tip of the iceberg, for every one big incident, and that's the tip that we can see, for us in the aviation world, that's a crash. It could be hundreds of lives lost. Beneath that, there will have been 30 incidents which have exactly the same telltale signs, where there was only a minor outcome, a minor negative outcome. So a report would have been put in, but it was a minor. But underneath that iceberg, sitting beneath that water level, you will have had 300 incidents with exactly the same signs which were caught. So to put it in a flying world, you go to make a switch selection and you catch yourself. You go, oh, shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
Now, can you imagine how powerful it would be if people started telling you what those near misses were? Yeah. And I call them 300 events, because suddenly you're not having your one big event and going, oh no, who can we blame? Oh no, something's happened. You're basically finding out what these events are before, and you can now be proactive, and you're working upwards. You're not reacting to everything that's happened. And this proactive nature is incredibly powerful. But to underpin that, you've got to have the right culture, and you've got to have trust. So you've got to sort of go, and where does that come from? Role model behavior from leadership. So actually you have to have everybody on board in this, right from the top and bottom up. And often where we find the sticking points are the leaders are all really engaged in it. The newcomers are very engaged in it. We have that middle band, often a middle management band, which is often stuck with, well, that's not the way we've done it in the past. Yeah. And I don't truly trust the hierarchy. So actually I might make mistakes, but I'm not going to tell people about them. And actually, do you know what? They don't really want to know at the top, because they don't want to tell their stakeholders that something's gone wrong. So I'll tell you what, we'll protect them by not telling them. But then that's where it sticks and it breaks down. So it's all about education. It's all about looking at, say, the culture of business. And, you know, when you do introduce, sorry, I am talking an awful lot, Amy, but when you do introduce a cultural change policy, you know, it's fascinating to see what people start to report on. They often report about things initially. I don't know, there's never any toilet paper, because they want to see, does something happen as a consequence of what you're saying? And then when they get a report back and they get some feedback and they see that there has been a change implemented as to what they've said, then the next thing they'll come about is other people. So we've gone through, let's say, the baby stage of waving your arms, looking for attention. You now enter the second stage, which is a teenage stage. It's where you blame other people. So you might have a shift changeover, and you might say, well, we got a really bad handover. So there was a mistake made, but it was not our fault. It was somebody else. Because you want to see, does that culture apply to them? And do they apply the just culture, and they don't get into trouble because they want to learn? And when you see that it does work, because that's still very limited risk to yourself, the next time that something happens to you, you've now got trust built up, and you will put in a first person report. You'll say, I made a mistake. And that's when you know, when you can look at the origin and who, what they're commenting on in reporting, you can therefore see whether or not you have got an embedded, good, safe and just a learning culture. So it's very easy to actually look at that and be able to almost catalogue it in some ways.
That's brilliant. And if companies were adopting this and any newcomers were coming in and were being taught this, then it keeps the process going, doesn't it? Then
it really does, actually. Yeah. So, and I know that there's a lot of work being done in the financial sector about this, actually. Some great papers have been written, and they comment about the what's actually happening. Because often, if you can imagine, you know, you've got that, if you can imagine that tier, or if you've got the top level, you've got the middle management, you've got the newcomers. Newcomers come in, report up to the middle managers. Middle managers tell the senior team what they think they want to hear so they can report it back to the stakeholders. And actually, that's not the war. So actually, if we're going to get to the root of what's actually happening, that's all about education, and it's all about trust, and it's all about cultural change.
Brilliant. Love it. I want to go on one of your courses.
Yes, you see, and I don't talk as much on my courses, I promise. I do empower people to speak.
Oh, I love it.
It's fun.
So, given that this is the Being Brilliant radio show, what would be your top three tips for being brilliant for our listeners to take away?
My first one would be build resilience. You know, we will all fail. And especially when I go into schools, I failed every single test to become a pilot in the Air Force. I've never passed any of them. I failed the first ones. I was told I had one more chance. I failed them again. And then I was told that was it for me. And I entered the Air Force as an air traffic controller, and I wrote letter after letter to anybody who would listen, sort of trying to point out my case. And I had about 200 hours of flying, and I joined a club at university, and the boss had believed in me of that club, and he'd requested that two impartial examiners had assessed me, and they had both graded me as being above average. And so we had proof in the air that I could fly, and yet we had a computer program saying I had no ability. So actually, I was not willing to just sit back. I challenged the system at every single turn. And I think that would be my big lesson, that, you know, big top tip is that, you know, when we do fail and a door shuts, to me, it's not about necessarily just saying, well, that's it, I'm going to turn away. I mean, if you, as a youngster, if you fail a driving test, you say, well, that's it, I'm just going to stop. Of course you're not. You're going to probably say, well, I need to do it again because this is a skill set I want to have. And actually, that can be devastating because, you know, often, a lot of kids, especially ones going through perhaps even the private sector, who have been very, very pushed by, you know, the system and actually a lot of self-induced pressure that they put on themselves because they're there thinking, I must perform, I'm in a highly performing peer group. They won't have failed at anything. And we're seeing one of the biggest dropout rates from that band of people when they get to university, because as soon as they fail something, they've never failed at anything. And it's about teaching people that it's okay to fail. And I know that, I mean, my children go to a wonderful school here in Winchester, and they have the first attempt in learning strategy. And the headmaster talks all the time about failing and how it's good to fail. And actually, we can never learn until we fail. And actually, the true mark of the person is the one that picks themselves up when things are not going well, as opposed to the ones that it just goes like a breeze through life. So I think resilience is my biggest one. And the second one is to be yourself. I think so often we try to fit in, we try to take on a persona of a group, or we try to be somebody that perhaps we believe other people want us to be. And I think if you can be true to yourself and you can try and find your passions, or just try to find an area that you love, and if you can make that your focus and that your goal, then I think you're halfway there as well to being happy. So that's my second one. Try to think of a third one and I can't offhand immediately, but those are my two biggies.
Great. Wonderful. Okay, fantastic. So I know you also, we mentioned just at the beginning, you work with a charity.
Tell
us a little bit about that.
Inspiring the Future, and it was set up by Miriam Gonzalez, Nick Clegg's wife, and she's a partner in a law firm, but she made it her passion to basically try to provide some really strong role models for schools, to go into schools. And basically their original aim was to get 15,000 women primarily, but men as well, to sign up to go into your local school. Within, you can tick in the boxes on the website, but you can go in and you say, I'm happy to walk to go a 20-mile radius from my home. And a school in that local area can contact you. And if you happen to be a nutritionist, for example, often people will have no idea what a nutritionist does. They might have a real interest in science, these children, or they might have a real interest in, say, food technology. And then suddenly a nutritionist comes in and tells them about what that job does. And you can almost see certain people's eyes lighting up and they're going, oh, now this looks interesting. But I think until you've met something, I think it's some shocking figure. Like 70% of children will not go into a career unless they have met somebody in that job. And that's why we have big problems a lot of times with things like STEM, the science, technology, engineering, maths type subjects, because actually often people are not meeting people in those areas. And there's a perception perhaps that it's a very male dominated environment in engineering world, or, you know, computer programming is very, and it still is, you know, I think it's 7% of girls take computer science at A level. Well, why is it so low? You know, that's even in all girls schools. So why is it so low when actually they're not creating a perception? And yet it can really be interesting to some people. So yes, this is a very interesting, I think it's a fantastic charity just to try to pick up all the resources of some very talented people in an area. And you could just be happy to go in once or even twice a year and talk to small groups of sixth formers or, you know, any sort of levels. So yeah, that's been a really great charity that I've been doing a fair bit of work with as well. So
fantastic.
That's good.
Inspiring the future. I'd love to get involved. I might speak to you off air about that.
Yeah, no, definitely. And another initiative that I'm involved in as well is we're trying to set up with, well, we're putting one on initially. It's called Attitude at Altitude. And it's just the first one that we're putting on is just a night down in Hampshire. And we're trying to get 400 people just to come along and inspire them with stories of some fantastic, really strong female role models. I'm part of the organizing team with a group of people, but there's a colleague that's walking up the Matterhorn that's raising money for her local for the local hospital, for the Murray Parish Trust. So we're raising money basically for Southampton General Hospital, and that's been a great initiative that we're just starting to try to get parents and children to come along for an evening of inspiration. So that's been part of another project that I'm involved in at the moment.
Wonderful. Oh, fantastic. So this is Amy Hackett-Jones from the Being Brilliant radio show speaking with Mandy Hickson. And you can find Mandy at www.hicksonltd.com. And her Twitter handle is at Mandy Hickson, which is very easy. Goodness me, what a whirlwind we've had. Thank you so much.
There you go.
A couple of tips for being brilliant were to build resilience and to be yourself, follow your passions and really breathe life into those. And yes, thank you so much for being here. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you. I feel like I can talk for hours about the future of leadership. It's just such a passionate subject of mine.
I believe in it so much as well, and I think you know, there's so much that you can do, and it's not just about reading books on the subject, you know, it's about living and breathing it and creating some absolutely fantastic role models for people to look up to, and I think that's the key to it all.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you so much. I really, really thoroughly enjoy this. It's been a huge pleasure to have you on the show.
No, it's been my pleasure.
Fast jet pilot, I just think that's the coolest thing. and how you've turned that around now, and the lessons are just so fantastic, what you've taken from the military and implanting now into business.
It's very enjoyable and it's quite exciting as well, because people sort of often say to me, do I miss it? And I miss the camaraderie and I miss the raw flying, but you know, the opportunities that are coming my way nowadays, you know, speaking at an International Atomic Energy Agency conference in Vienna to nuclear scientists one day, and speaking to a primary school of children from Wolverhampton the next. You know, actually, the breadth of the people I'm speaking to and getting that message out to, it has been phenomenal and very exciting inside itself.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
That's my pleasure.
And thank you all so much for listening in. Thank you, everybody. Be sure to tune in again 2 weeks from now. And in the meantime, go out there, be your brilliant selves, be the lighthouse, shine your light no matter how fierce the storm. And I will see you or hear you, speak to you all again in 2 weeks' time. Thank you so much, Mandy. It's been a huge pleasure.
Thank you, Amy. It's been my pleasure too.
Bye for now.
Bye.
I can do anything. I can reach any goal today. I can do what I want. I can be what I want to be.
Coach on Fire Radio.